Hello and welcome to Out in the Bay, gay radio from San Francisco. I'm Eric Jansen. Tonight, the art and science of growing from adversity. That topic was suggested by my in-studio guest tonight, a former colleague from the San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus. He's co-author of the fascinating new book, Super Survivors, The Surprising Link Between Suffering and Success. The book tells stories of survivorship and explores the science of post-traumatic growth. Nearly half of the world's population, say the authors, will endure some sort of trauma during their lives. Some will experience severe post-traumatic stress. Most will eventually recover and return to life as normal. But some survivors do more than bounce back. Some bounce forward. These are super survivors, individuals who not only rebuild their lives, but thrive and grow in ways never previously imagined. Interviewing dozens of such super survivors for clues, the authors found some surprises. Certain delusions can be healthy. Forgiveness may be good for the body as well as the soul. Positive thinking can actually do us harm after trauma, and reflecting on death can lead to a better life. Co-author David B. Feldman says the findings are particularly relevant to LGBT people, and as they are to other members of, dare I say, minorities who have endured discrimination over the years and eons. As he puts it, so many of us have faced significant loss, trauma, and other adversity during our lives, and yet often find a way to thrive and build community. One of the fascinating people profiled in Super Survivors was a self-hating gay man who turned pro-gay activist after a series of traumas and now helps people recover from so-called reparative therapy, which he was originally a proponent of. We'll also hear during this hour from singer-songwriter Mary Lambert, yes, the one who sang with Madonna at the Grammys and was a big splash last year and in 2012 with hip-hop duo Macklemore and Ryan Lewis, writing and singing the chorus to their marriage equality anthem, Same Love. She's endured her own traumas and challenges, some of which she spoke and sang about at the Luscious Queer Music Festival last month, where she was warm, delightful, charming, and oh-so-talented. Mary Lambert will perform at the Norse Theater in San Francisco September 27th. Don't miss the show. We'll have more on that coming up. We'll play some of her singing, her powerful lyrics this hour, so stay with us. Super Survivor co-author David B. Feldman, Ph.D., is an associate professor of counseling psychology at Santa Clara University. His research and writings concern how people maintain a sense of hope, purpose, and meaning in the face of trauma, loss, and adversity. Dr. David B. Feldman, welcome to Out in the Bay.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's great to see you again. It's been a few years.
Good to see you, too.
So you say that half of us will experience trauma. Define trauma. I mean, I think when I hear the word trauma, I think of losing a limb, losing a leg or an arm in some accident, losing eyesight or hearing, losing a loved one to a car or a plane wreck or violence, some violent act. You know, or but are there also less sudden, perhaps ongoing things? Is that included in the definition of trauma?
All of that is included. The actual statistic, and whenever I bring this statistic up, people are shocked. In fact, a lot of people don't even believe me. But it's based on studies, national studies and worldwide studies of just hundreds of thousands of people. The statistic is between 50% and 80% of us at some point in our long lives will encounter a trauma. And that's all of the things that you just talked about. Trauma is a tough thing to define, but the way that we zoomed in on it in the book, when we selected the people to interview and the cases to talk about and also the science to look at, was life-altering events, events that make you think that you're going to die, that can disfigure you. We have people who have had brain injuries and other sorts of bodily injuries, who have lost legs, that threaten your life in some way. We profiled people that had cancer. We also profiled people who had catastrophic financial loss, because that too is a threat to your life, at least at the very least your lifestyle, but it can make you feel like it's a threat to your life. These are really serious events, and that's what we profiled in the book. We also hope, though, that the principles that we talk about in the book can help all of us, because even if you're not unlucky enough to be in that 50 to 80% of people who have a trauma at some point in your life, all of us have setbacks and losses and obstacles. As you said before, I think the gay community, in a huge way, it's hard to be gay in America and not have had serious problems in your life, have confronted serious setbacks in your life as a result of that, have wrestled with your own internal prejudice, have faced other people's prejudice. It is a fact of life that we encounter problems. So how do we deal with that? How do we not only bounce back, but bounce forward?
Right. So you, in the process of doing this book, you interviewed how many people roughly, and how did you find these super survivors?
So we interviewed over 100 people. And we profiled 17 in the book because it's impossible that we could have written 10 of these books. We started with the science about what helps people to not only bounce back from trauma, but to bounce forward and go on to do amazing things. You know, something like 20 to 30% of people who encounter trauma end up with post-traumatic stress disorder. We're all familiar with that, the nightmares and the flashbacks. It's a very important topic. People with PTSD absolutely deserve treatment. But little do people know that something like 50 to 70% of people in the aftermath of trauma grow in some way. And the science is really clear about what that happens. Yeah, more than half. Absolutely. So we wanted to find people that really exemplify different kinds of growth. And so we went on the internet, we looked on Google, we looked at TED Talks, we looked on YouTube, we did all the detective things that any reporter would do. And here's the interesting thing to me. We would reach out to someone with an email or with a call, and almost always we were greeted with these amazing people that had founded NGOs and had been appointees on the Holocaust Memorial Council by Obama and had been world record holders. They all said, I'm not a super survivor. Mm-hmm. I don't rise to that level. You should talk to my friend who's a super survivor. And then we talked to that friend. And then they said the same thing. And we talked to another friend. Mm-hmm. And we ended up amounting these enormous lists of incredible people who have bounced forward and have amazing lessons to teach us.
Right. You know, it's interesting. It reminds me of Del Martin's, the late Del Martin's memorial service. Her daughter spoke, and she said something that I remember saying, that my mother didn't want to be thought of as an extraordinary person. Mm. She was an ordinary person who did extraordinary things. And, you know, maybe that sort of fits in with this.
Absolutely.
So give us some of the, you know, you've got 17 stories in this book. Which ones particularly stand out for you?
Well, the one that really was the story that launched a thousand stories, if you will, was a woman that we interviewed early on named Asha Mevlana. And my co-author, Lee Daniel Kravitz, and I were sort of banting about, should we write a book on this topic? Is there really enough there? How common is this? Turns out it's pretty common. But we met Asha. Asha, quickly to tell her story, she was a workaday businesswoman in her 20s living in New York, living a very good life, making a good living, but an unexamined life. And then the unthinkable happened. At 25 years old, she was diagnosed with breast cancer, and she thought she was going to die. No 25-year-old should have to seriously think they're going to die. And she underwent a year of chemotherapy. It was a particularly virulent cancer, very, very threatening to her life. Well, luckily, the chemo worked, and she was put in remission. It's been more than 5 years. She's quote-unquote cured. But the hard thing for her was getting back to her life afterwards. She said she tried to go back to her job, but she realized after confronting her mortality that maybe she wasn't living the kind of life that she wanted to live. That's one of the things that trauma does to people. In addition to being incredibly painful, it kind of forces people to step back and look at their life and ask themselves, am I really living according to my values? Am I really doing what's important and meaningful to me? So flash forward a few years, she is now quite literally a rock star. She ended up taking improvisational electric violin lessons, something she never thought of doing, just as a hobby. She had a friend who said, you should move to L.A. from New York, where you might be able to get paying gigs. And she did it. She took the leap. She moved to L.A. One thing led to another. Her violin teacher connected her to a guy who repairs violins. She ends up auditioning and playing with Twisted Sister, playing with Jay-Z, playing in front of just millions of people over the years. She was on the American Idol band, on The Tonight Show. Just an incredible story. And granted, there's a lot of luck in this story, but the important thing is she decided, because of this trauma, I need to do something different with my life. And that's a commonality that we see to all of these stories in the book.
Yeah, and I think especially like it's a wake-up call, like life is short. You never know how long it's going to be.
Yeah, and that's easy for us to say. I mean, everybody knows that life is finite, right? Everybody knows that it doesn't go on forever. And yet, the thing that's common, well, one of the things, there are eight principles we talk about in the book, but one of the things that's common to all these super survivors is they have a confrontation with the shortness of life.
Mm-hmm.
They have an experience that makes them step back and say, okay, I thought it was going to go on forever, but it's not.
Right.
So
right.
Given the fact that it's not, who do I really want to be? It's life's difficult, and you get to determine where you go within limits. And these experiences help people to see that.
Now, you said you have a section, you have a reading from the book about Asha's story. Do you want to read that now?
Yeah, sure. I can do that. This, as I said, she starts as a businesswoman in New York. And she contracts cancer, and she goes through chemotherapy. And this reading starts just after her she is declared cancer-free. And it talks about her experience that a lot of people with trauma talk about, which is getting back to their life after confronting their mortality. In the aftermath of her cancer diagnosis, Asha paid for improvisational violin lessons. Her teacher took a unique approach with her. Quote, "She asked me to play how I felt the day I walked into the hospital to get treatments," she explains. Quote, "She didn't want me to use any words, just my instrument. It was the first time I felt close to my instrument and was actually able to improvise from my heart, excuse me. Looking back, I was actually meditating on my instrument. I played the anxiety I felt when they injected me with chemo. I played about trying to be strong for everyone else, even though I was terrified. I learned how to express myself through my instrument." Before the trauma, Asha had no illusions about making a career out of music. Quote, "You mean playing for bar tips? No, it never crossed my mind. I was just way too practical," she remembers. But the pragmatism didn't survive the chemotherapy. After working hard for many months, she played electric violin for a few amateur rock bands. This was a new and invigorating experience for her. She hadn't hung out with people like this before. All her friends were either investment bankers or corporate suits. Something about this new life clicked. Perhaps it was the unscripted nature that, much like the music itself, was creative and freeing. A couple of months later, when a friend invited her to visit L.A. for a weekend, she met a number of local musicians who convinced her she could get paying jobs in California. Before her cancer diagnosis, Asha believed, like many, that mature adults should settle into a routine life and count their blessings. Quote, "I wouldn't have ever told anyone I wanted to be a rock violinist," she said. Nobody even knew what that was. "But it was always in the back of my head. I'd never taken any risks before. Everything I had ever done had been calculated. I stuck to things I knew would be successful. It would be an enormous risk." She had no job prospects in L.A., no income, no place to live, and a million reasons to go back to her old life. Then again, she was 28 years old, one of the youngest survivors of breast cancer she knew, spiritually damaged and more than a little lost. From this perspective, she had nothing to lose. And you know the rest of the story. But she moved. She took that chance. And she worked really hard. It's not as if this all happened magically. But she ends up playing with some of the biggest names in rock stardom today.
That's David B. Feldman reading from his book, Super Survivors. And you can, this is the only day during the fall membership campaign that Out in the Bay will be on the air. So this is your one chance during this week and 2 day period to show that you appreciate Out in the Bay. We're going to hear more from the book, definitely. For a donation of $75, this book can be yours. The number to call is 800-525-9917. That's 800-525-9917. Or you can go online to kalw.org. Let's talk a little bit about, like, the book is in sort of in sections about sort of themes.
Sure.
And we talked a little bit on the phone before we met about positive thinking and how that can be possibly damaging.
Yeah, it's interesting. As a psychologist and as an American, right? Americans are so positive. We're always taught, think positive and everything will work out for you. So my co-author and I were shocked when we asked survivors, what helped you to bounce forward and become a super survivor and do the amazing things that you did? And what everyone started with is what didn't help them. And that was positive thinking. I'll give you an example. A guy named Alan Locke had always dreamed about a career in the British Royal Navy. He's a British guy. And he achieved that in his 20s. And then something horrible happened. He suddenly went blind of macular degeneration. It's a genetic condition. And he lost his career. And all this happened in about a month. And of course, he fell into depression, and it was a very difficult time for him. If you fast forward a couple years, he becomes the first blind person ever to row a rowboat across the Atlantic Ocean or to trek across Antarctica. And he holds two world records. And when we asked him, what helped you? He said, let me tell you, positive thinking, did not. All of his friends, after his trauma, said to him, think positive, look for the silver lining. It's this stuff that people say a lot when we go through hard times. But he said, look, I didn't feel like thinking positively. In the aftermath of trauma, pretty much nobody does. So does that mean I'm doomed? And this is the problem with positive thinking. If you believe that positive thinking helps you live longer, if you believe that positive thinking cures you of cancer, if you believe that positive thinking creates your reality, you've also got to believe that if you don't think positively enough, or if you think negatively, bad things could happen.
Right.
And that can be very self-blaming, and particularly in the aftermath of difficult times, when you try to force yourself to think positive, it feels not genuine, and it sort of re-victimizes the person.
Right,
so
right.
What Alan said helped him was realistic thinking, something that we came to call grounded hope, which was a thread that weaved itself through the book. Trying not to paint a smiley face over problems, thinking realistically about them, and then asking yourself, what do I do next? Given where I am in my life, given that I can't change what's happened to me, given that I have to accept some aspects, he had to accept that he was blind and he wasn't getting his vision back. How can I build the best life I can on top of that, and taking one step at a time towards important goals to build a meaningful life? Very pragmatic approach, not quite as positive as the smiley face positive thinking,
right,
but very effective.
And in that same chapter, there's a swimmer who has, I can't remember what the problem he had was, but some
leukemia.
Severe illness, leukemia, right. And he said, you know, I just, all these people were telling me, oh, you know, just be positive thinking. You can beat this cancer just by positive thinking alone. And you mentioned Barbara.
Ehrenreich,
because I remember her, an interview I heard with her saying, like, you know, cancer survivors, I hate it because it implies that somebody who doesn't survive, somehow they did something wrong.
Yeah, Barbara Ehrenreich is a acerbically witted commentator and essayist, and she was diagnosed with cancer a few years ago. And she writes about this, and she said she went on the internet looking for advice about how to cope with cancer and make herself better, and she expected to have all kinds of saccharine philosophizing. But she said what really threw her for a loop was that over and over and over again, she saw this phrase, you caused your cancer, and you can get over it with positive thinking. This idea that your thoughts create reality. I mean, to a certain degree, that's probably true. But she said she felt like it felt very self-blaming, that she should somehow feel guilty for not being able to think more positively. And this actually depressed her. It made her feel worse. And a lot of people who have been through hard times, and not just cancer, whether it's financial losses or losing your house because you can't afford the mortgage or any number of things, certainly, I mean, if you think about gay kids who find out they're gay and live in an environment that doesn't accept that. I mean, there is this notion that you, through your thoughts, should be able to just snap and change things.
Right.
And that's not the way reality works.
Right, right, right. I'm going to shift gears a little bit here, and this is we're definitely breaking my normal format here, but I wanted to get some music into this hour, and by coincidence, I went to see Mary Lambert a while ago at this the Luscious Queer Music Festival up in Lake County towards the end of August, and I didn't know much about her before that. She was I knew she was kind of a pop star, and she'd been in this song with this hip hop duo Macklemore and Ryan Lewis, I think his name is, like, you know, and friends had told me, oh, you have to see this. She's doing this thing about gay marriage and same love and all that stuff, and I was like, you know, it was nice. It was like, oh, well, that's impressive. It's nice to know that, you know, she's out there, but I just thought of her as being really passionate. Packaged. And then I went to see her, and she was so genuine. She's like, I don't know, I think she's in her 20s, or early 20s, I believe. I'm not exactly sure how old she is. And, you know, just yesterday I was looking at more about her bio, and she considers that some of her past traumas are being raised in a strict Pentecostal household, being repeatedly molested by her father as a child, abusing drugs and alcohol before being diagnosed with bipolar disorder, and surviving a gang rape at 17. So that's obviously a lot. And she talked freely at this concert that I went to about her own destructiveness and her body shame issues. She's a little larger than average, perhaps. And she, as a matter of fact, she's got a poem book called something about 500 Tips for Fat Girls or something like that. But anyway, so she starts this thing off. I'll just warn you, the lyrics are kind of heavy, and I've cut out the F words for radio, for public radio. But this is called Body Love, and she starts it by telling, she's in a good place now, but she went through some hard times.
Hello. I'm really, really happy about where I am at this point in my life, and it was a long road to get here, and I was very self-destructive in my process, but through that I've learned a lot, and so I like to speak up about self-destruction and about the growth that can occur afterwards. So this is a poem called Body Love. Who are trying to fit into the social norm like squeezing into last year's prom dress. I know girls who are low-rise, MAC eyeshadow and binge drinking. I know girls that wonder if they're disaster and sexy enough to fit in. I know girls who are fleeing bombs from the mosques of their skin, playing Russian roulette with death. It's never easy to accept that our bodies are fallible and flawed. But when do we draw the line? When the knife hits the skin, isn't it the same thing as purging? Because we're so obsessed with death. Some women just have more guts than others. The funny thing is women like us don't shoot. We swallow pills, still wanting to be beautiful at the morgue, still proceeding to put on makeup, still hoping that the mortician finds us fuckable and attractive. We might as well be buried with our shoes and handbags and scarves. Girls, we flirt with death every time we etch a new tally mark into our skin. I know how to split my wrist to reveal a battlefield too, but the time has come for us to reclaim our bodies. Our bodies deserve more than to be war-torn and collateral, offering this fuckdom as a pathetic means to say, I only know how to exist when I am wanted. Girls like us are hardly ever wanted, you know. We're used up and sad and drunk and perpetually waiting by the phone for someone to pick up and tell us that we did good. Well, you did good. I know I am because I said I am. I know I am because I said I am. I know I am because I said I am. My body's home. My body's home. My body's my own. My body's my home. Try this. Take your hands over your bumpy love body naked. Remember the first time you touched someone with the sole purpose of learning all of them. Touch them because the light was pretty on them, and the dust and the sunlight danced the way your heart did. Touch yourself with the purpose. Your body is the most beautiful royal. Fathers and uncles are not claiming your knife anymore, are not your razor. Put the sharpness back. Lay your hands flat and feel the surface of scarred skin. I once touched a tree with charred limbs. The stump was still breathing, but the tops were just ashy remains. I wonder what it's like to come back from that, because sometimes I feel forest fires erupting from my wrists and the smoke signals sent out of the most beautiful things I've ever seen. I know I am because I said I am. I know I am because I said I am. I know I am. Because I said I am. My body is home. My body is home. My body is home. My body is my home. Love your body the way your mother loved your baby feet.
Actually, let's let this go a little bit longer.
Shoulders, remember, this is important. You are worth more than who you fuck. You are worth more than a waistline. You are worth more than beer bottles displayed like drunken artifacts. You are worth more than any naked body could proclaim in the shadows. More than a man's whim or your father's mistake. You are no less valuable as a size 16 than a size 4. You are no less valuable as a 32A than a 36C. Your sexiness is defined by concentric circles within your wood. It is wisdom. You are a goddamn tree stump with leaves sprouting out. Reborn.
That was Mary Lambert reciting and singing Body Love at the Luscious Queer Music Festival in Lake County, Saratoga Springs Resort Center in Lake County last month. My apologies for talking over one bit of that. I'd planned to fade it out early, but decided we needed to hear just a little bit more. You're listening to Out in the Bay. My guest is David B. Feldman, author of Super Survivors. And this is the September membership drive edition of Out in the Bay. We do this twice a year is all. So now's your chance to show some support for Out in the Bay and for KALW both at the same time. And we have a special challenge grant from supporters of Out in the Bay and supporters of KALW. Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Portola Valley have put out this challenge, $100 extra for KALW for every new member during this hour, up to 5 members maximum. But every $100 for every new member. So if you've been listening for a while to KALW or just happen to be tuning it out in the Bay at this moment, you know, any level, $100 extra if you're a new member. The number to call is 800-525-9917. That's 800-525-9917. You can also go online to kalw.org. And we have a special thank you gift. Mary Lambert, who you just heard, she will be performing at the Norse Theater in San Francisco on Saturday, September 27th. And for $125 donation, you can get a pair of tickets to this concert. Now, of course, you could go buy those tickets online yourself at City Box Office for less. But if you do this, you're supporting Out in the Bay and KALW at the same time. $125. And if there's some other gift you'd like, go to kalw.org and check out the choices. There's only 3 pairs of these tickets, though, that we have available. So if you want those, please do call 800-525-9917. That's 800-KALW-917. Or again, go online to kalw.org. We also have Super Survivors. We've gotten 5 donated copies. And thanks very much to David B. Feldman, who's my guest. He's co-author with Lee Daniel Kravitz. The book is Super Survivors, The Surprising Link Between Suffering and Success. The authors interviewed dozens of men and women whose stories serve as the counterpoint to, to bring out the fact that there can be growth from tragedy, after tragedy. And it will reset your thinking about how we deal with challenges, no matter how big or small. That's yours for a donation of $75. And again, the number is 800-525-9917 or online at kalw.org. Thanks so much. So, David, back to David B. Feldman. Thank you for being here. And by the way, it's almost 7:30. This Way Out will not be heard this time. We're doing a full hour. This Way Out will be back next week. You had not heard Mary Lambert's that particular song before, I don't think.
No, I haven't. It's beautiful.
What did that bring up for you, and how it possibly relates to some of the research some of your findings and advice you might have for people?
Yeah, a couple of things it brought up. The first thing was, here is a woman who has obviously been through incredibly hard times. I mean, that is a true story, I believe, about her and her life. And she has found a way of taking that suffering and somehow turning it into inspiration for her music, doing not only an amazing thing for herself and being successful, but also doing an incredible thing for the world, spreading this message of acceptance and, I have to say, hope to people. So she's definitely fits our definition of a super survivor. And what really comes up for me is she's also had a lot of pain. And I think a lot of people want the way of getting out of the pain. They want that magic solution, that magic pill, to leap over the pain and get right to the super survival part, right to the part where they do amazing things. We are a culture that really wants quick fixes. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that we found in the book, the science shows this very clearly, and also the interviews we did shows this very clearly. You can't leap over the suffering, the loss. The only way through grief is through it, right? Right? You have to go through it to get to the other side.
And if you try to avoid it, it's probably going to take longer to get through it.
If you try to avoid it, it just chases you. It just chases you. So a lot of the people that we talked to said, yeah, I'm a super survivor. Yes, I've gone on to do amazing things, to found companies or found NGOs or become rock stars. But I still suffer. You know, still at night, sometimes I have nightmares. I still cry from time to time. It's still hard. These two things, suffering and success, are not mutually exclusive. It's one of the reasons we called the book, the subtitle, The Surprising Link Between Suffering and Success, because we didn't want to give the impression that you could leap over the suffering, that in fact it is the suffering that helps you to realize what success for you really means and helps sometimes to push you forward towards doing amazing things.
So let's talk a little bit about Michael Busey's story. He's the one gay person profiled in the book. Is that right?
Yeah. We actually had several people that we looked at because we really wanted to put a story like this in the book. And my co-author Lee, who's not gay, and myself, I am, we went back and forth about whether to include this in the book. And we were both a little uncomfortable about it because he founded an organization, which I just believe is an awful organization. But his story is that he was a little kid. He was 10 years old or so. And his classmates, he was being raised in a fairly small town. His classmates started calling him a homosexual. He'd never heard this word before. He grew up in a very right-wing, religious, conservative family. And so he went to the library to look it up. And the only books he could find on homosexuality at the time, this was decades ago, was in the Deviance and Abnormal Psychology section of the library. And he thought, oh my God, I am a deviant. There's something wrong with me. And he believed, he went on a quest basically for years to try to change himself, to convert himself. And this quest led him into his 20s to join a very conservative church and to start an organization that was called Exodus International. And maybe your listeners know about it. It became the largest religious organization, actually the largest organization in the world, that attempted to convert people from being gay to being straight, this so-called reparative therapy that science shows very clearly doesn't work. And he saw that it didn't work. About 10 years later, in the 1970s, he realized that he was still gay. And not only that, but many of his quote-unquote clients had gone on to dismember themselves, to slice into their skin, to run their cars into trees out of shame. And also, Michael was not cured, and in fact, quote-unquote cured, and in fact, he ended up falling in love with his co-founder, mm-hmm. Gary.
Yes, many of us have heard this story.
They started a romance.
And some people kind of snicker and laugh about it, but it's so, for them, I mean, I'm sure it was so painful and true.
Well, we asked Michael, like, what happened to send you on this road? And he said, look, he said, people don't think of it this way. He said, but for me, growing up in the environment that I did, finding out that I was gay was a trauma.
Right.
It was my first trauma, and it was horrible. And it sent him down this really negative path. He ended up coming out and living an out gay life with his partner. But he really remained in the closet, so to speak, about being a founder of Exodus. He never spoke out about it, and he felt really guilty about it. And all this changed, and this is where we get to the part about super survival, when he encountered two traumas. The first one was his partner, Gary, died of AIDS. This was during the tail end of the AIDS HIV crisis. And
the worst of it.
The worst of it. It's still going. It's still
right?
going. Absolutely. No question.
Yeah.
No question. And
So this is around what year, roughly? We're talking like...
This was the late 80s,
okay.
I believe. Early-ish 90s,
okay,
maybe.
Right.
And then the other thing that happened is shortly thereafter, Michael was the victim of a gay bashing. He was stabbed multiple times. And in fact, the friends that he was with died in the ER. And this caused Michael to step back and say, whoa, I was part of of creating this environment that is so horrible for gay people. This is not the kind of life that I want to lead.
Because the attack against them was specifically an anti-gay attack.
Yeah, okay, it was a gay bashing. It was specifically an anti-gay attack. And he said, I got to do something to change my life, to live really in a meaningful way for me. And so what he did was he became a vocal advocate against Exodus. He went on news programs. He wrote an open letter apologizing for his part in founding Exodus. And not only that, he confronted the then president, this was now 2 years ago, of Exodus International on the Oprah Network, mm-hmm. along with other people who had been wronged by Exodus. And all this led in large part to Exodus closing their doors forever. And
actually, I think I saw one of those clips a while ago. I can't remember the guy's name right now, but he sort of...
I don't remember the president.
Yeah, yeah. He also was in denial. He sort of admitted his own same-sex attractions, and yet he was married to a woman and continued that because he loved her.
He continues to advocate for the fact that people can choose their lifestyle. But he says, look, the organization did horrible things to gay people. And for that, I'm sorry. I mean, I think it's controversial whether they really meant it when they shut down, but they did shut down.
Right.
And now Michael Busey, this super survivor, is now runs an organization, forgive me, I don't remember the name right now, that helps to support people who are victims of reparative therapy and helps people to be comfortable in their own skin. And he is now a pro-gay advocate and activist.
Right.
Just an incredible story of how this journey can be punctuated with trauma, the first of which was finding out that he was gay in this environment that told him that it was wrong. And then it was a couple of traumas that really jarred him out of that to say, okay, I need to be okay with who I am. You know, Mary Lambert's song that you played a few minutes ago had this lyric, "You are worth more." He realized, I'm worth more than this.
Mm-hmm.
And he began to change his life.
By the way, I do want to mention for you listeners that Mary Lambert's, not all of her stuff is that heavy. I chose a couple of the heaviest songs to play because it fits in with this theme. But yeah, it's beautiful, and her lyrics are amazing. But if you decide you want to go to this concert, don't be put off that it's all going to be down, because she's actually really delightful. She laughs a lot when she's doing her thing. And so I'll mention it one more time. We have been donated 3 pairs of tickets to Mary Lambert's appearance in San Francisco Saturday, September 27th at the Norse Theater in San Francisco, and that's for a donation of $125. And we have also the book, Super Survivors, by my guest David B. Feldman and Lee Daniel Kravitz, and that is for a donation of $75 to KALW. The phone number is 800-525-9917, or go online to kalw.org. I'll give the phone number again in a minute, but I want to also remind you that Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Portola Valley have generously put up a challenge, a specific challenge. They want new members to join KALW, and they will donate an extra $100 for each of the first up to 5 people who become new members. We can say, you know, we'll slop over past 8 o'clock because we know that David and Mary Lambert are so riveting that you don't want to call during that. But jot this number down, 800-525-9917, 800-KALW-917, or go online to kalw.org. There was something you looked like you're about to say something. Okay. In this chapter about Michael Busey, I think James Cameron is in the same chapter. There's some talk about faith and belief in, and because I think this is an interesting contrast. Early in the book, you're saying, well, positive thinking isn't necessarily all it's cracked up to be, and it could be a bad thing, but a trauma can also cause someone to reexamine their faith. And that I think you cite some studies that show a difference between whether people believe in a God or a higher being that's benevolent as opposed to one that is punitive.
Yeah. So one of the principles that you know kept coming up when we started to interview people about super survival, and people kept asking about too, is how important is religion and spirituality in helping people to overcome traumas and setbacks and obstacles in life? And what we found when we looked at the research is, well, first of all, you've got sort of 2 kinds of people in the world. You've got those people who say faith is a really good thing. Everybody should have it. Everybody should be religious. And you've got the people on the other side that say it's bad. Everybody should be an atheist. You know, religion is the bane of existence. Turns out probably neither one of those are true. What really matters is if you have faith, what you believe. You know, there's an incredible diversity of beliefs. And it turns out some of them are comforting. when you encounter hard times, and some of them are not so comforting. There was a study that was done a couple of years ago that looked at people with AIDS and that were, you know, very seriously sick. And it interviewed them, and it also looked at a lot of their, you know, viral load and immune functioning. And one of the questions that they asked them was, if you believe in God, do you believe that God is a loving, caring, forgiving, nurturing God, or do you believe that God is a judgmental, harsh God that is looking for sin, that, you know, that chooses who goes to heaven and goes to hell? And what they found was the people who believed in the harsh, judgmental, cold God had a higher viral load. They had worse indications of immune functioning. And the people who believed in a forgiving, caring, warm God were doing better health-wise. This is just an amazing finding that really shows that the kind of religious beliefs you have really matter for your physical health and for your mental health.
So where's the advice in there? How do you change that? Because that sounds to me like the advice of, oh, you know, if you're a depressed person, you just need to pick yourself up by the bootstraps and change the way you think. And I would assume that someone to change their thinking about whether they think God is benevolent or punitive would be the same kind of, you know, how do you do that?
I think it's a process. I don't think you can force it. What I recommend to people very often is if they notice that they're having a lot of guilt, if they notice that they're that when they're in church or when they're engaging with their religion, that they really feel bad, that they feel like that God is punishing them, to go and try to talk to their pastor, their minister. Look, that's not always good advice because you never know what the pastor or minister is going to say. But to also try to talk to a variety of different people from a variety of different perspectives. Ask what they think. I've seen this work with people that I have seen as clients in the past, where when they really start exploring it, they realize that there's a much wider range of beliefs, some of which actually deep down, maybe they believe even more. That story that I told of Michael Busey, the self-hating gay man who ended up becoming a pro-gay rights activist, one of the things that he did was he noticed his religion change. He says, now, I still believe very much in God. He still calls himself a Christian. But he says, through my experiences and through meeting different people and through talking to different ministers and different people of faith, I realize there's a different way of being religious. There's a way of being religious where you can believe that God is accepting and loving and warm and helps those who help themselves and wants people to be happy. So I think you've got to explore. Very often people put themselves in a box and aren't willing to explore. And I just tell people, go out, explore, see what you can find out, talk to different people.
So speaking of warm, bad segue, but we're going to go back to Mary Lambert because this is... Here's an example of someone who went through some really hard times and has come out of it with a more positive outlook on life and a more sense of purpose. And so we played this song before, which is fairly dark, and there's some other songs that she does sing that are fairly dark about dark topics, but she's gone through them, and that's why she's singing them. She wants other people to realize they're not alone. But anyway, so this is a song that she's probably most well known for and that, you know, shows more positivity. So this is Mary Lambert, She Keeps Me Warm.
She says I smell like safety and home. I named both of them. Even if I wanted to. if I tried, even if I wanted to.
Was Mary Lambert singing She Keeps Me Warm. She doesn't perform it solo that often, so that's a little bit rare. That was from the Luscious Queer Music Festival at Saratoga Springs in Lake County last month. And she will be performing in San Francisco on September 27th at the Norse Theater, or Norse Auditorium is at the Norse Theater. And for a donation to KALW of $125, you can get a pair of tickets and be supporting KALW and Out in the Bay at the same time. And you can also get David B. Feldman's book, Super Survivors. We've been talking about super survivors. Mary Lambert's an example of a super survivor. And I also want to acknowledge one more time Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Portola Valley. Thank you so much. They've put up a special challenge during this hour, $100 for every new member who becomes a new member during this hour, during Out in the Bay, and what would normally be This Way Out during this hour, but we've preempted it just for this half hour. This Way Out will be back next week. So, again, give us a call at 800-525-9917 or go online to kalw.org. Thank you so much. So, David, we were just talking about Mary Lambert being, you know, she's come through this to a place of acceptance about herself and who she is and proudness of that. And we've been talking earlier this hour about the traumas of being LGBT, being gay or lesbian or bisexual or transgender in the society, and that's difficult and it has some traumas, and as other other minority groups do and have other people face discrimination. So how do we not say, oh, poor us, we're victims. And
Yeah, I mean, I think the first thing that we should do is acknowledge the ways that we have been victims historically. I mean, LGBT people have suffered incredible discrimination over the years, and I don't think we should be in the business of denying that. I mean, we still are fighting for our right to be married, you know, and of course we're having a lot of victories. But I think to be gay is to have instances where you've been discriminated against, where you've been told people don't like you because you're gay, because where you've been fired from jobs or you've had housing discrimination. I mean, this is common. I don't think we should run away from it, but I also think we should acknowledge the incredible resilience of the LGBT community. I mean, if you look, despite all of this, these setbacks and traumas, here are just some statistics that I looked up. Gay households earn on average $8,000 to $11,000 more than straight households. And of course, that's not to disparage straight households in any way.
Now, is that true? Because I've heard conflicting research that that's maybe true in the bigger cities, but not so much true in, you know,
it
rural areas.
It depends by region. This is the national statistic. And this was given by a survey, a big national survey of about 1,500 households across the nation that was done in 2012 by Prudential, the banking company. They also found that there are modestly lower unemployment in gay households. Education is higher. About half of LGBT people hold college degrees, and about a third of everybody else does. It turns out LGBT people have more equity in their homes. They're more likely to save for retirement. None of this is trying to say that LGBT people are superior in any way than anyone else. I think that this is a super survival effect.
So it's a sort of they've been challenged in a certain way, and that challenge is pushed to them.
Yeah. And that's not to say, I mean, as a gay man, I would gladly give up any of those so-called advantages or any of that super survival that I talk about for living in a world that just accepts me as I am. And yet I do think that the human spirit has an amazing ability to transform suffering into success. And I think you see that in these strong communities that we as LGBT folks have built.
So let's talk a little bit about forgiveness. There's a chapter in the book specifically about forgiveness. What's the role that that plays or can play?
Yeah, forgiveness is a tough one because, I mean, some things just seem unforgivable. We interviewed a woman by the name of Clementine Wymeria, and she was a little girl living in, 8 years old, living in Rwanda when the genocide there started. And she and her sister, this is about 20 years ago, escaped out the rear window of their grandparents' house and hid in a field of banana trees, I believe. And they heard screams from inside the house, and they thought their whole family had been killed. In fact, most of their family was. And they bounced from UN refugee camp orphans to UN refugee camp, just horrible places to be for years until they eventually made it to the United States as refugees. If you fast forward a number of years, Clementine is now a Yale graduate. She speaks routinely for the UN against genocide. She is a presidential appointee by Obama to the Holocaust Memorial Council. She works with Oprah Winfrey in Oprah's Leadership Academy for Girls. Just an incredible super survival story. And when you ask her, what helped you to do this? She says, forgiveness. She says, forgiveness. And that just flabbergasted me. So I asked her, well, what do you mean? And she said, well, she told us, and the research, 20 years of research on forgiveness really bears this out, that what most people think forgiveness is not accurate. A lot of people think forgiveness is a gift we give to the perpetrator, the gift of clemency, the gift of pardon, and that's not at all what it is. Forgiveness is really a gift we give to ourselves. The gift is the permission to not forget the past at all. Clementine actually speaks to the UN routinely about genocide and how to help prevent it. Not to forget the past, but instead to give yourself permission to let go as much as you can of the anger, the resentment, the rage, the hurt of the past, and to turn your sights forward towards the hope of creating a better tomorrow. And the perpetrator doesn't even have to know that you have forgiven them. And Clementine says, I don't even know who my perpetrator was.
Right.
But I have realized that we are all human beings and we are all bound together on this planet. And I need to find a way of leaving the hurt behind me and making a better world. Mm-hmm. And that to her is what forgiveness is. And I think that's a lesson we all can take to heart as much as we can to practice that in our daily lives.
Yeah. And speaking of daily lives, I mean, how this book is about the people you present in this book have undergone some significant traumas and challenges.
Sure.
And how do those of us who haven't had significant big challenges or, you know, trauma per se, how do we take this advice, or what advice is there in there for us?
Well, there are three or four things that I think we can all do to prepare ourselves to be super survivors, but also to take any suffering and setbacks in our life and turn them into success. First thing is, and we talked about it early on, be realistic. You know, denial or distortion of what's happening to you, painting a smiley face over it, telling yourself everything's okay when it's not, may feel good in the short term, but in the long term, it's really hard to deal with problems unless you first acknowledge those problems and realize what you can't change. Then you can begin to take steps to change what you can. Second of all, focus on what you can change. Even in the midst of suffering, take a step back and ask yourself, what do I really want my life to look like? Suffering is painful. Trauma is painful. Setbacks are painful. But they also present a kind of perverse opportunity to examine your life. So remember to take that opportunity, even though it may feel hard. And the third thing is, and we haven't talked a lot about this, but I want to bring it in. Notice the people who are there for you and call upon them. One of the major themes that we talk about in our book is the power of support, of social support. And I know that when I came out and when I came to the Bay Area 10 years ago and joined the San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus, I was newly out of the closet. I needed that support. I needed people to help me figure out who was I now and how could I be myself. Social support, it turns out, and being open to social support is one of the most important ways that people bounce forward after difficult times. But you got to be open to it. You got to accept it.
You're listening to Out on the Bay. I'm Eric Jansen. My guest is Dr. David B. Feldman, co-author of Super Survivors, The Surprising Link Between Suffering and Success. We've only got a couple minutes left here. There's so many great stories in this book. Can you just sort of give it like a, well, I'm going to, off the top of my head, I'm going to think of a few, and I want you to add a couple. There's this James Cameron who basically was about to be lynched, a black teenager in the South in the 1930s.
The last survivor of lynching. I know that sounds strange, but he had been involved as ancillary to perpetrating a crime, which he actually ran away from and did not end up perpetrating. But before he could be tried in 1930, a KKK mob broke into his jail cell and attempted to lynch him. And something mysterious happens. Nobody knows what, but the rope went slack and he was let down from the tree. Some people think that it was the victims of the families who said he wasn't involved. Some people think it was the sheriff who stepped in. But this event really caused this boy, really, this teenager, to say, I got a second lease on life. I'm going to do something great with it. And Dr. James Cameron, who died in 2006, became a great civil rights leader and helped to desegregate housing in Milwaukee first, but then all across the U.S.
And there's the story, we can't go into the details, but there's the story of the housewife and mother in Belfast, I guess it was, who, you know,
Betty Williams,
witnessed these kids being run over and killed by this
as part of the fighting in Northern Ireland,
went on to found this Mothers Against War type of, I don't know the exact name of the organization, but anyway, the book is
won a Nobel Prize.
Yeah, won a Nobel Prize. So this book is full of fascinating stories. And we've got to wrap it up now. David B. Feldman, thank you so much for being here. Where can folks find out more about the book?
Well, you can go to supersurvivors.com, or you can look up Super Survivors on Facebook and like our page. And there's all kinds of updates there.
And you can get a copy of the book by becoming a member of KALW or making a donation. If you already are a member, making an additional donation of $75, you get the book Super Survivors by David B. Feldman and Lee Daniel Kravitz. The number to call is 800-525-9917. That's 800-525-9917, or go online to kalw.org. And another thank you gift during this hour, well, it's available past this hour, but we only have three pairs, so do it fast. A pair of tickets to see Mary Lambert, the singer-songwriter who has just an incredible lyric. She's a beautiful songwriter. She has a gorgeous voice, and she's a big star. And frankly, I've heard that this concert is kind of underpublicized, so you can see her in a very intimate setting. This theater only holds about 1,000 people, I think, so it's going to be great. Saturday, September 27th, a pair of tickets for $125 donation to KALW. or pick another gift if you'd like. KALW.org. That's online at KALW.org or call 800-525-9917. You've been listening to Out in the Bay. We'll dispense with our usual credits, but because I don't have them in front of me like I usually do. But I want to thank Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Portola Valley for putting up a special challenge during this hour, $100 extra for every new member. If you're a new member, if you haven't been a member, join now, any level, $25, $10, $50, we hope, or more. But any level, they will chip in another $100 up to five new members during this hour. So do it. You got 10 minutes to do it. 800-525-9917. That's 800-KALW-917 or online at KALW.org. I'm Eric Jansen. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you.